And now it's time for wait a minute. What the hell is the show called again?
It's Chatter on Books. What else do you want me to say? Can I go now?
That's right. It's Chatter on Books. Let's do this thing.
And we are back.
Yay!
Yes, it's been a couple of weeks.
Whew. Yeah.
This is our first show in the year 2019.
No, we did. We had one at
New Year's
the
Eve show.
Of the year.
Yeah.
We had the New Year's Eve show.
New Year's
and
Eve.
we had January 7th.
We
and
did?
It's terrible.
Did we?
It's like fortune cookies. I can't remember who was on that show. But yeah, we did one.
It's good to be back in studio.
Yeah. It's great to be back.
Tori Clark is back from her world travels.
Cambodia and Vietnam. Made it this time without being detained by the government. There were a couple moments on our trip where officials would look at our passports kind of funny and, can we hold on to these for a minute? I thought, here we go.
I've seen an Inception.
But not this time.
Come see us in our education camp.
Yeah.
You'd be so happy here.
Exactly. But we would get straight. Every once in a while, a guide or somebody would say to us, have you ever been to Vietnam before? Expecting us to say no. Well, as a matter of fact, 1990, most of them hadn't been born then. But it's great to be back. It's great to be back. And we've got Mark and Jeannie and Michael and David. And we've got some great stuff on tap tonight. First off, Pride and Prejudice and Social Commentary, anniversary of Pride and Prejudice. Book reviews gone bad. I'm having a pop quiz for you guys a little bit later.
Okay.
And our guest authors this evening are Pulitzer Prize winners Mary Jordan and Kevin Sullivan. They happen to be married. They happen to be best-selling authors. They're already getting rounds of applause with a huge crowd out in chatter.
I love both of them.
Yeah.
I love people who win Pulitzers because I never won any.
But you know what? Between Tony's show and this show, we all now know a lot of them.
I know.
Yeah. So, everybody else has got them,
won.
David.
They've each won Pulitzer,
I know.
Right? That's
awesome.
Pretty good.
So great.
Pretty good.
Yes.
Little housekeeping. We are on Twitter. We're on the World Wide Web, Chatter on Books. Follow us on Twitter. Follow us on Instagram. Review us. Download us. All of those things. Right, Mark, that we want people to do.
But be kind to us.
Yes.
Be very,
yeah.
very kind to us.
Just be honest.
Say something nice.
Yeah.
You know.
We are now, this is, I guess, episode 8, I think it is.
Wow.
And I was saying before the show,
grade 8.
I continue to get emails, texts. I got a note in the mail. People, they've loved all the shows. They really love Donna Brazile, and they want Donna to do a cookbook. And they would like, this makes Mark's head explode, they want Chatter on Cooking done out of the kitchen at Chatter the Restaurant, where we are at the corner of Wisconsin and Jennifer Streets Northwest.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wait a minute. A spinoff of a spinoff?
Yeah.
Yes.
This would be like Aftermath. It would be awesome.
Great. Oh, yeah. In fact, Jamie Farr would star in this as well. So I'm excited about that.
Okay, so first up, Pride and Prejudice. Who read it? Michael, hands up.
I never read it.
Read it, caught it. I'm only here for P&P talk.
I'm going to. You guys
seen
go
every
ahead.
Adaptation.
I'm going to have another Irish coffee. Let me know when you're back.
I proposed to my wife with a line from Pride and Prejudice.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm not going to say anything. I was going to say go. Michael, go.
I cannot fix on the hour or the spot or the look or the words which laid the foundation. It is too long ago. I was in the middle before I knew that I'd begun.
Wow.
And she said yes.
Wow, that's great.
Wow, because she was so in awe and shock of your doing that. That's spectacular.
Well, P&P was her favorite book in high school.
Oh, okay, she should be on the show then.
Yeah.
We should have her talking about it. So it was
because of the entail, I'm male, so I'm here. If you read the book, you'd get that.
It was published on this day in 1813. Jane Austen sold it for £110 then, which is about $9,000 now.
Okay.
And that's, I think, all the money that she saw from it. BBC did a poll last year, I think it was, for all-time favorite books in the UK ever.
Mm-hmm.
And this came in second right behind Lord of the Rings.
Okay. Mm.
And Michael, to what you were saying earlier, lots of adaptations, lots of modern-day adaptations. Which ones are good? Which ones are bad? Which have you loved?
I think you have to start with the definitive BBC one that we probably remember from the 90s when they did it in installments on PBS over here with Colin Firth. And I think her name is Jennifer Eel. I don't know if I have the pronunciation correct. Mm. But it created a new mold as to what we thought Fitzwilliam Darcy should look like,
which
is that lord as he's coming out of the lake with the shirt sticking to his body, which had the young women up in arms.
Is that why your wife loved it so much?
I think she's still looking for her Mr. Darcy. They had a very, I think, well done but limited modern or 2005 version that was done by the director Joe Wright. If you remember, he did the zoom in with the hands, which was a move he was doing in Atonement as well with Keira Knightley and Matthew McFadden. And the fault there is you just can't capture everything that is involved in a very detail-driven social commentary. So it was a little flat in that area, but it continued that pulp culture look at what we think of Pride and Prejudice, which is this, you know, opposites attract and fall in love in a very chaste way.
Yeah, I was reading about the anniversary and then the spinoffs, and I thought there are so many different paths you can go down with this. They used romance as to describe or to investigate social commentary. Bridget Jones' Diary, because I'm the cheap, superficial one here, is the one that I thought of.
Yes.
But there are so many different avenues people now use to figure out what they want to say about social commentary. Scott Price that we had on, Mark Leibovich was the first person we had on the show. Scott was the second one we had on the show, mm-hmm. who used sports in a southwestern PA town, hard knock town, to do his social commentary, hillbilly elegy, if mm-hmm. you will. David, any favorites?
Well, along those lines, the first book that really did that was Friday Night Lights by H.G. Bissinger, which looked at Permian, Texas, mm-hmm. and the same kind of social, racial, economic cleavage that went on in that town, but was temporarily put aside because of the exploits and the success of the local Permian Panthers football team. But once the star running back, I think his name was Booby Clark, got hurt, all of those kind of cleavages came back immediately to the fore, and people thought he was lazy and that he was, he was wasting his talent, and there was a lot of anger that the coaches didn't do more to help him become a better player and a better student, all those things. So I think that certainly is the modern day kind of, across the tracks type of story.
Yeah. Jeannie, any favorites?
Well, I'm going to go cheesy 2019 here.
Go. It's so early in the year.
The Bachelorette.
The Bachelorette.
This is a social commentary?
You've got one of the Bennett girls sitting in a chair, picking from among Darcy Wickham. I'm sorry.
Mr. Bingley.
Mr. Bingley. Don't you see it?
No.
You don't
see it? Well, and then with the cast off, you have Charlotte Lucas, who, by the definitions of that world, is the most successful in that she has absolutely no avenue to success, and she gets the marriage. She gets the successful, Mr. Collins, who is the cousin who is going to inherit Longbourn, the family estate.
I think I probably read it 9 million years ago, and then I had absolutely no interest. Because I've always had a theory in my family that my four older sisters read too much. They read too much of these kinds of things when they were mm-hmm. growing up. And mm-hmm. so they had these great expectations, to make a pun, that that's how life was going to be. And then when they actually met life, say when they were in their 20s, they were very, very disappointed. Mm-hmm. Mark?
Well, I think the only modern example I can think of this is the television show Pardon the Interruption. I think that is really... No, I was just thinking of this right now. I was not a huge fan of this book. Yeah. I think I've discussed this before.
Me either.
I was upset that we weren't spending more time on Coleridge and Wordsworth, and nobody wanted to talk about that except for me. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I don't care that these women want to get married. And for me, too, it's a fascinating point of time because this is the early 1800s. This is the battle between England and France. This is the Battle of Trafalgar and Napoleon and Waterloo. This is all going on around this, and it's like everybody's just concerned about marriage. And I was like, these were huge world events that were going on, the French Revolution.
Yeah.
And in the English countryside, it seemed like it didn't matter. But Jane Austen perfectly captured sort of the mindset of what was going on in her world at that point. So... Now, I just thought of this, and you guys can laugh me out. We can edit it out if it's totally stupid. Mm-hmm. But would Crazy Rich Asians be a modern commentary about this kind of stuff?
I actually thought about that.
Yeah.
And then I wasn't going to mention it because then I'll sound like the really cheap, superficial one.
Well, now I've only seen the movie.
I've got that card.
It wasn't even The Bachelor. It was The Bachelorette.
You've read the book, though, Crazy Rich Asians,
right? Yeah, no, I have. And I think that comparison definitely does work. What I would encourage you to think about is the actual evolution of the novel. And if we think about the novel of manners, we see an author who for the first time is really having us read something that's conversational. It's not the epistolary novel, which you might have seen glimpses of that as you're writing these letters back and forth. It's not an epic. It is not sort of a story of a battle. It's not something that's totally driven by a moral fable. So there is something about creating that realistic look at what is happening for your life.
Great point.
And with regards to even someone like Charlotte Lucas, you look at survival. What does it mean to survive? Like the path of marriage is really to to be able to continue to live, not even just live comfortably, but to make sure you have your path.
Wow. This is why Liz said yes.
I was way smarter than I am.
I couldn't remember reading Pride and Prejudice, I was thinking, okay, what did I read when I was much younger that was like this? And when I was a kid, I read Black Beauty a million times over. Mm-hmm. And Black Beauty ostensibly is about this horse who was mistreated, and it's about kindness and respect and decency towards animals. But it was really about, it was written in the late 1880s, I think, 70s, mm-hmm. 80s, sold about 50 million copies over the years. But it really was the larger social commentary about people needed to be kinder to mm-hmm. one another mm-hmm. and be humane to everybody, no matter where they came from. Right. So, wow, Michael, that is great, though, the proposal. That's fabulous.
Yeah,
that's
awesome.
Great job.
Okay. Black Beauty, 1877. Yeah. Believe you had that.
There you go.
Thank you
Believe
very
you
much.
Boom.
If you're
looking for a modern version, which takes this out of that world of marriage and puts it into a modern day, I think it's Cincinnati, take a look at Curtis Sittenfeld's Eligibles.
Yes.
Yeah.
And what I really like about that is that it captures the folly of the father, because so often we focus only on marriage and the path for these daughters as the mother is trying to marry each one of them off, and Lydia runs off, and every girl is trying to avoid being the Mary of her
mm-hmm.
family.
Uh-huh.
And we forget that the daughter, or the father in this, is a caricature of this landed gentry, the guy who can't break the entail, who can't really support his daughters, who just retreats into his office. And we see a modern day version of that where the dad manages the family business, which is essentially just taking a look at the various trusts and is basically letting the family and the house go to ruin.
Which reminds me just quickly to recommend the novel March about the father of Little Women.
Oh, right. Oh.
It is a great, great, you never hear about him, but this is from his perspective.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I always, having Michael on the show is like, or being in Michael's presence is like having a living Cliffs Notes.
It's like, that's right. It's like having,
it's fabulous.
You know, a PhD in residence.
It's fabulous.
Just remember, my good opinion, once lost is lost forever.
Oh, made me cry.
He was the guy I wanted to sit next to in class.
Exactly.
Just move your arm just a little bit.
Move
a little bit.
All right, this is Chatter on Books. We are at the corner of Wisconsin and Jennifer Streets Northwest. We encourage lots more people to come down, although it's getting a little crowded in the restaurant.
Yeah, it's great. Yeah. Good
and drinking like fish.
In a little bit, we're going to have our guest authors, Mary Jordan and Kevin Sullivan, join us. But first, I love pop quizzes. I absolutely love pop quizzes. And I'm now obsessed with reading various book reviews.
Okay.
From various sources. But what I'm going to do now for the gang here is I'm going to read you.
Why are you looking directly at me as you're going to your notes?
Because you're
this
the smart one.
Yeah, we're
you're the smart one.
You're the Kate Jackson of this show.
I memorized quotes from 300 years ago. Come on, I don't know these reviews.
There actually
all
is
to
this,
impress a girl.
There is this great debate going on now with truly famous authors who do not like what goes on online. Mm-hmm. And so Anne Rice and some others are petitioning Amazon, saying you have to take a stronger hand on the kinds of people say when they go on and review books. And it can't be all personal and this and that. But
yeah, because it can get fairly nasty. As with most things on the internet.
Yeah, right? As most things, anything to
Yelp
do with
reviews,
social media.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I pay no attention to Yelp reviews or any of that anymore.
No, I don't either.
Because the only
can't.
People who go and do it are the people who've got a complaint about something.
Exactly.
They're trying to get something for free.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, so here's the pop quiz. I'm going to read you a couple of reviews about mm-hmm. famous books.
Okay.
And I'll leave out the name of the author and the book title, and you have to guess.
Okay.
And there really are clues in each one of these. Okay, the first one up is from The New Republic. Jeannie's taking notes.
Can you give us the year?
No.
Can you use it in a sentence?
No.
Genre.
No. Okay, so here's the important part of the review. A master of the concentrated short story, blank, that's the name of the author, is less sure in his grasp of the form of the elaborated novel. The shape of, name of this book, is sometimes slack and sometimes bulging. It is certainly quite a little too long. This was in The New Republic. And there are clues in that.
F. Scott Fitzgerald.
Herman Melville.
No, but there was a fabulous one about Moby Dick, which is my most hated book, but I didn't use that one.
Okay. Edgar Allan
Poe. A master of the concentrated short story.
That's
the quiz.
That's a guess. I like that guess.
No. It was in The New Republic. It was For Whom the Bell Tolls.
Oh. Mm.
Right?
Well, it had the right age group.
Yeah.
Yes.
Gerald Hemingway.
Yes.
Okay, this one is from, this does date it a little bit, the New York Herald Tribune book review.
Okay.
Blank, the name of the author, has the jitters. Looking back over his career, one can see that he has always had them in varying degrees. He rushes headlong into the great pamphleteering movement. Blank is a lugubrious, I cannot say that word, and heavy-handed piece of propaganda. Mark should know this one.
Well, that gives it away. It's George Orwell.
Very good. Brave New World. Wow. Yeah. Ding, 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 ding. Good for you.
Okay, I was going to say Sinclair Lewis, but I would have been wrong.
Okay.
Okay.
I would have gone with that. I would have taken that answer.
Mm-hmm. Here you go. Okay, last one's New York Times. I happen to feel that the book would have been infinitely better had it been edited down to, say, 500 pages. But there speaks the harassed Daily reviewer, as well as the would-be judicious critic. Very nearly every reader will agree, no doubt, that a more disciplined and less prodigious piece of work would have more nearly done justice to the subject matter.
Hmm. Where's the review coming from?
New York Times.
New York Times.
Pumping irony.
Oh, yeah. Bold as I want to be. Something that was a little too long.
Easy guess is War and Peace, but...
At Tolstoy. You got
it's kind of warm.
War, what's it good for?
Gone with the Wind.
About that.
There you go.
It's really pretty. If you just, because, you know, my life is Google. You just Google bad book reviews. There, of course, like everything, there are books about bad book reviews. Mm-hmm. And there's this long, 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 long list of famous, very successful books that have held up for decades and initially got horrible
reviews. Well, it's like if you read there's always one guy that's behind the train or one woman. And you see the review of Sgt. Pepper, you know, and this guy's like, it's terrible. This is just overproduced and it's miserable. And then like a year later, he's like, actually, I've gone back and listened to it. And it's pretty good.
Well, that was the case with the New York Times music critic.
Oh, really?
Oh, panned it. And then they went back like 25 years later. Oh, sure. Oops.
Sorry.
My bad.
Sorry.
Simon the Sea Cat getting great reviews.
Yeah.
Yes. And we might have some exciting news about that.
Ooh, the plush toy?
No. A second book. Yeah.
The next day.
Yes.
Simon the Sea Cat's illegitimate child?
No, this is an entirely different book. This would be a book about a dog on the Titanic.
Thank goodness.
It's a great story. It's a legendary tale of a dog on the Titanic. I won't give away the details, but we are in talks with a publishing company about
just tell
book
me
number
that,
two.
Tell me that Rose let the dog on the piece of wood at the end of the... Jesus. You move over for
there's
God's
no
sake?
Room.
There's plenty of room for two here.
If you moved over, Rose, we both live.
Just tell me, does the dog make it?
You got to buy the book.
Right? Oh, man. Okay, I want the plush toy.
Yeah, no, it's... Again, this is the lesson I got from my great friend Jim Dyke.
Yeah, cat can't die.
Cat can't die, the dog can't die.
Yeah.
So,
okay.
The dog lives.
Dog lives.
Right. I will say that.
It's Chatter on Books, and now is our the best part of this show, our featured authors.
Yeah.
Mary, where's your husband?
Mary and Kevin.
We need Mary Jordan and Kevin Sullivan to join us.
Put those drinks down.
I need more drinks.
Yeah.
Where's our man to get us more Irish coffee?
Woo, woo.
Oh,
yay.
They have an entourage. Look at this. This is awesome.
Since we're not equipped for two, you two have to share a microphone.
Yes.
Michael, come on down this end and share with us.
Yeah, I gotta get
please.
Let's get a chair for Michael over here.
Yes.
And where is Dustin? He's the most important person here this evening.
We need
hold on a second.
Is Dustin?
Booze,
is Dustin? Oh, Dustin's the waiter.
Yes. More alcohol. We're taking a brief break here at Chatter on
Books. For those scoring at home, Tori's leaning out the window and yelling at Dustin to give us more booze.
Are you guys good?
We're so good.
You're good.
You're good.
Unless there's
whatever.
Jeannie.
I'm good, thanks.
Tor, you and I are having the same, so one of each.
Yeah, another round all around.
You can see what
orange
a
whip,
disciplined
orange whip.
Podcast this is.
Dustin is completely ignoring us, I just want to point out.
We're talking on the microphone. Somebody bring booze up into the studio. There we go.
Somebody out there, please send Dustin in.
Yes, Dustin.
We will not continue.
So I just
heard Mary Jordan was going to be here.
I just want to vamp a little bit about Mary and Kevin. But
it's your show.
But first... when I first started working at the Post, I remember I was working on the editorial page, and Mary was a Metro reporter, I think, for the Virginia desk.
Right.
And I remember one of the stories she was working on when I first knew her was about a guy, a pilot, who was in a plane, and I think, if I got this right, he fell out of the plane, and the plane crashed without him. Was that the story?
Probably. I remember.
Jeannie has an amazing memory.
When there was the guy who was the heir to the flow-through teabag fortune, got hooked on cough syrup, and was going around all the drugstores in Northern Virginia, writing himself codeine cough syrup. But
awesome.
He made his money through the flow-through teabag. So anyway, those were the days. Good
those
stories
the
in Virginia.
They
the
were
pilot
great.
Dropping out of planes.
And they'd give them big play, you know. It was sort of like the Lorena Bobbitt story, you know, just
Are you kidding? Nothing
that,
but reading.
Nothing's like the Lorraine
Bobbitt.
That
was a Virginia story.
Do you remember when Ben Bradlee was asked to come down in the newsroom and because that story, they were saying, this can't be true. This woman couldn't have done that. You can explain.
Okay, this is a woman who was so irate.
Everybody knows Lorena.
About what, if you don't know, so irate about her husband's treatment of her that she took a knife and whacked off.
She whacked an integral part.
A very important part of
him. Yeah. While he was asleep.
But wait a minute. We're talking about a nun tonight.
Yes, we are.
Exactly.
Okay. And
that's
sacrilegious.
Get back in line, people. Back in line.
That lovely voice you hear is Mary Jordan, who is sitting next to her husband, Kevin Sullivan, who are, we love saying Pulitzer Prize winners because it makes us feel important.
Woo.
Pulitzer Prize winners
too.
For their...
We say it as often as we can.
We do not.
Absolutely. It's on their address. Are you kidding?
The two things I saw most often reading about both of you, Pulitzer Prize winners and reporting duo.
Yeah.
Because it is really pretty remarkable. And I think the next book you write should be about your marriage because you have worked together and reported together for many, many, many years and lived in different places around the world. And you won your Pulitzer for your international reporting, correct? Specifically about the Mexican justice system, or lack thereof. And you've written two incredible books. The Prison Angel, which is about a L.A. socialite who becomes a nun in a horrible prison in Mexico. Mm-hmm. And this book called Hope, a memoir from Cleveland, which is about those young girls who were taken for 10 years, I believe it was. Most of them 10 years. Jeannie and I talked about it before the show. Both of them remarkable. But I want to start with the marriage. How has it survived what you two have done with your career?
People say to Mary all the time, how is it possible you can work with your husband? They never say that to me. They understand how that works.
People used to always ask Joyce Rumsfeld. I worked for Don Rumsfeld, who was unique. And people would ask Joyce Rumsfeld, oh, my God, how have you been married to him for 50 years?
That might be a
Dustin.
Different question.
Thank you so much.
And her answer always was, well, Don travels a lot. But what was it like? What has it been like working together and reporting on things together?
I think it's odd not to work together. You know, I think one of the great pieces of advice I ever heard was I was traveling on the Virginia desk.
Yes.
And this priest said to me, you know, I hear you're getting married. My advice is spend a lot of time together. It's people that don't do things together that end up in trouble. Well, we write together. We've written thousands of articles together. Kevin calls it Lennon-McCartney at the keyboards.
Humbly. Humbly. Yeah.
Which
he
one's
says,
Lennon? Yeah, this is very important. Which one of you two is Lennon?
She's the cute one.
What's the writing process like? Earlier in this show, we had Sarah Pekkanen on, who, by the way, it's pretty cool to go through the airport and see her next book, the one she talked about, Anonymous, is doing very well. But she has co-written quite a few books with another woman whose last name is Greer. And she talked about how they would get on the phone together and they'd share the document in front of them on Google Docs or something like that and literally went through line by line together.
They're not in the same room.
One's in New York, one's here. But how did you guys, when you worked on something together, what was the writing process?
We literally had desks that faced each other. You see, we have hecklers out here. Do you see the hecklers?
I love
this. They're banging on the windows.
Every Pulitzer Prize winner should have hecklers.
We have our own team hecklers. We literally had desks that faced each other. And the way this would often happen is I would start writing something and then give it to Mary, and then Mary would fix it, make it better.
Uh-huh.
And then she'd pass it back and forth. And we would just pass things back and forth. And it was literally, you know, kind of all art, no science. It was just...
Have you seen the movie The Wife with Glenn Close?
No.
And she was the surprise winner, Mark Wright, in the Golden Globes.
Yeah,
and then she won last night in SAG.
Gotcha, yeah.
And it's not normally something I would go to see. Well, maybe this would not be good for your marriage. But it's really something. He's a Nobel Prize winner for literature.
Oh, yes.
But
yes,
it turns out she's really the one behind the scenes who has been doing all of it.
When we won the Pulitzer, Mary's mother, Mary's Irish immigrant mother, was going around telling everybody, did you hear Mary won the Nobel Prize?
Yeah. Yeah. I said, Mom, that's $1 million. You don't get $1 million. You know.
And Kevin
and
gets,
it was
Kevin
also known as
along.
Mary's Pulitzer.
But, I mean, the truth is, I could keep doing the reporting, and Kevin is, you know, it's a great balance because he starts writing. You know, we actually have a deadline, let's go. And he's a very good writer. And so it just works out. It just
amazing. I think the main secret is that we're not competitive with each other, because if you're writing with someone and you're competitive with them, you're sunk. Like, we regard each other's success as our own. And, you know, I write something good, Mary's happy generally. And when she writes something good, I'm happy. And it's, you know, it works that way. If you're competitive, and we've known journalist couples who are competitive, and it's horrendous.
Yeah.
I don't know how you do it. I have often thought about, my wife's an anthropologist, got her PhD in it, and we've always talked about doing a book together. But I know that after 6 months, I want to shove a poker in her head, or vice versa. And she, I just know it. This would happen.
Yeah. A few years
ago. But, you know, it's really fun when you work together. So we get to interview all these really interesting people. Like, we went to Buckingham Palace and interviewed the Queen. And if I was just going, or Kevin was just going, and come back and tell this cool story, it'd be different. And then we can laugh about it together, you know, when we... So we've had these great, you know, we've lived in three different continents and written thousands of stories and interviewed, you know, mob bosses, gone into prisons, hung out with Paul McCartney, interviewed the most cool woman in Pakistan who was helping people in domestic violence. And we were there together.
Yeah.
So tell us about the nun. You guys have covered so many things, Taliban leaders, drug dealers, everything. And tell us about how you first found her.
So I'm sitting in our office in Mexico City one day, and Mary takes a trip to Tijuana, and she comes back, and she says, I met a woman today, and we're going to write a book about her. And I said, really? Who's that? And she said...
Not a story. We're going to write a book about her.
We're going to write a book about her. And she said, she's a nun. And I said, no. Not doing a nun book. Not doing a nun book. This is not going to happen. And she said, you go to Tijuana, you meet her, and you tell come back and tell me you don't want to write a book. And she was absolutely right. The second we both met her, we knew that she had an amazing story and we wanted to tell it.
First of all, she was divorced twice. And the original way that she became a nun was she was helping prisoners in this really poor prison where, you know, people in the prison at that time in Mexico, which wasn't that long ago, you had to pay rent in the prison. So if you were a drug lord, you could have furniture, a jacuzzi, you know, and if you were like this poor guy that stole a loaf of bread, you're on the basketball court. So Mother Antonia, this nun, she was a divorcee who was going into the prison, bringing bandages and food and peanut butter, and she sewed a fake nun outfit and wore it. She was not actually a nun.
What a good idea.
But they
said,
you
want to be a nun, look like a nun.
There's a lot of criminals in this prison, and with this... this outfit, they won't touch you.
Yeah. And she went to the bishop in Tijuana and the bishop in San Diego and literally got down on her knees in front of each of them and said, you know what I'm doing. You know I'm doing good work. Please bless me. And they both did. But one fantastic little side story here. Can I tell the story?
Yes.
So she told us that, we didn't hear about this until after. So she was, Mary wrote a story about her that appeared on the front page of the Washington Post. And there's a guy who lives in D.C. who read the story, looked at the picture, and thought, I know her. That's Mary Clark. It was his girlfriend in World War II.
Oh, my gosh.
So he decides he wants to get in touch with her. He writes her a letter, care of the warden at the prison in Mexico. And they get together, and they speak on the phone for the first time in 57 years. And that's that's Ned Connor, who's sitting here with us tonight.
That is so welcome.
Awesome. Hey,
oh, my God.
Ned.
Wow.
That is so awesome.
That is fabulous.
Thank you. That is so great.
And Eddie O'Connor, who is here, he's going to be 95 in June, is one of the coolest guys going. And they were... teenagers writing back and forth, and Mary Clark, this gorgeous. I mean, she looked like Doris
You
Day.
Look at the pictures.
Gorgeous.
Yeah. As somebody needs little words
Even
and big
as an
pictures.
Even an older woman, you could tell she was really
She was gorgeous.
And you guys traded letters like every 2 weeks all through World War II, right? For much of it?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. That's a whole nother
book.
That's
so interesting about life's turns, right? Because... he was the last to come back after the war. She ended up getting married. She married the wrong person. She got divorced
twice.
Twice.
And she was pretty depressed. And she was 50. And she said,
Children.
Seven.
Yeah.
Seven children.
I want to do something with my life. And there's all these plastic surgeons and people with a lot of money in La Jolla and people right across the border that have no money. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to be the conduit. And she would go and scoop up things at the end of the day at restaurants and bring them across the border, bring them into the prison. So when she started, she was just a mom who mm-hmm. was doing this. But eventually, we said that she had that fake nun outfit on. Eventually, she actually did become a nun that was ordained.
They created a new order.
Yes.
Right?
The Pope met her.
And she lived in that prison for 35 years in her own cell.
I want to read something from your book, The Prison Angel, and to talk about the kinds of things she did, because when you think about the arc of her life, it was incredible. And she really had a huge impact on so many lives. But this is from her. She said, "People think what I do is so extraordinary. But look at me. What am I doing? Anyone can do it. There are so many things people can do. It doesn't have to be enormous. It's the little things. Anyone can make a sandwich." And it seemed like every day she was making someone a sandwich. She was giving somebody some money. She was had a jar of peanut butter there in case somebody who was hungry. She did a million little things.
But she did unbelievable big things, too. She decided early on that she was going to help fix people's faces, because she said, if you can't look in the mirror in the morning and feel good about yourself, how is anyone else supposed to feel good about you? So she would go to La Jolla, and she would go to these kind of fancy places in California, and she would recruit, she would shame these dentists into coming down and working on teeth for free, and plastic surgeons. We talked to a plastic surgeon who charged, you know, like $1,500 a minute for his work or whatever it was. And
it was stretching Cher's face one day.
And then he would go to the prison, and he did more than 1,000 plastic surgeries, a lot of them to remove tattoos.
Wow.
So these guys could actually go apply for a job and be taken seriously.
And there was a woman who had no legs, right? And she got her... She got her teeth done, saying, well, if you can't have legs, at least you can have a nice smile. Just absolutely remarkable woman.
2,000 different people who had no teeth she got teeth for. She said, and talk about the little things, they can smile, they're going to be better off.
Yeah. And she did as much with the guards as she did with the prisoners. And clearly it was a bad relationship between the guards and the prisoners. But she did as much for them, thinking they needed to be part of this as well, right?
And it's so interesting now, because we're talking about the border, and here she was going on one side of the border, bringing, trying to make things a little more equal. You know, there's such wealth on one side, such poverty on the other. And it's interesting in this time that there's been so much more interest in her life. We keep getting emails about people, about her ministry, because she's recruiting older women to help her. She calls it the servants of the 11th hour. You know, you could be 80, you could be 90, you still got something to do. You can help.
She died 5 years ago, and I was in Mexico a few months ago and went to her place and met all the women who were in the order, and they're from all over Mexico, they're from all over the United States. Her legacy lives on.
That's fabulous.
Part of it is she just saw people. She didn't see guards. She didn't see prisoners. She just saw people. She hated it when you called someone a rapist or you called someone a thief. And she'd say, no, it is a person who committed that crime. That crime shouldn't define them forever.
So speaking of legacy, movie in the future? Can you talk about that?
There actually is. There were some complications with the movie rights in the early years. But now, in the past... since roughly 2016, we've gotten a lot of people calling wanting to do movies, and there's a movie deal in the works now.
And the coolest thing is that the money, most of it, because when we met Mother Antonia, we told her that the book and the movie, the money would go into her order, so it'll do good things.
Wonderful.
Nice. Great. That's wonderful. Fantastic.
Yeah. Very nice. And who do you want to play her?
I mean... are you available, Tori? Because you know we have there is an opening.
Sure.
There are many roles I can play. None is not.
I don't know.
Heart of gold? No.
Yeah. No.
Churches would
spontaneously combust.
We hear that Brad Pitt wants to play the intrepid reporter who met her.
Yeah, that's right.
Who's going to play Eddie? Who's here with us? We have this dashing
Christopher Plummer.
Zac Efron.
George Clooney.
Because you know. Later in life, when they reconnected and started sending notes of support about how their lives, you know, because of a lost letter in World War II, they didn't get married. She went on to do this. Eddie has this fabulous family, fabulous wife, fabulous kids. And it's so wonderful that they reconnected later in life, too. So anyway, that's a nice little sidelight, too.
I think, well, I'm trying to think when the last time people actually wrote letters. But my dad served
80s.
In the Army in the end
no, in
of...
No, in the 80s. I wrote letters in the 80s.
Before email.
Oh, sure, yeah. Sure, sure.
The end of World War II, my dad was in the Philippines, and he was dating the woman who became my mom. He married. And I've got 300 letters that they wrote to and from one another, and it's just remarkable. Because it's 3 years, and each letter would start out with something very... matter of fact, this is what I did today, this is what happened, the kind of, and then they go into something, and then they had really interesting, really meaningful conversations, and their relationship developed. She was very Catholic, he was not. Their relationship developed, and they had all the conversations you should have about mm-hmm. marriage via these letters.
Did they write with emojis or like LOL or
anything? Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Okay, so that's fabulous. Everything you guys have done is fabulous.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah, go.
You wrote a story, Mary, about a prison island, Isla Maria Madre. Is it still going on? And tell them about the island, the prison island. Yeah.
The way to get there was either an 11-hour boat ride off the west coast of Mexico or a really long helicopter ride.
But those are both fun rides if you're a prisoner.
Wow. I mean, there was a supply plane and there was no seats. So I was strapped to the wall and there was toilet paper and things for the prison all around me. And so when I went out there, and I'm motion sick, so it was an ugly sight.
Oh, my God.
But basically, it was an experimental prison, very mm-hmm. interesting prison, where there were no bars. There were sharks around the island.
Trapped
and you couldn't
island.
Get off.
So it's like Papillon, like that kind of deal,
exactly.
right?
Yeah.
Like you're here and you're never getting off.
The sharks kept you on.
Yeah.
Sharks
but,
in the water.
But it's looks like the island where Tony wants to send people he hates. Right? Just like that.
Yes. On the pontoon boat.
I mean, there was a bakery, there was a school, you could bring your girlfriend, you could bring your wife, your kids, but you just couldn't get off.
No bars. Was it a success where, like, did they, live together in peace and harmony, or was it, like, chaos?
Well, the success was that they were saying that people were hardened in prisons, right? And mm-hmm. you were meeting other prisoners, and you were getting tips. And
getting better at being criminals.
Yeah,
right,
getting better at being
this was to teach people crafts, like, if you get a job in the bakery, you'd learn how to make, you know, croissants, and there was a music school. So in some sense, it was a success, but it turned out to be really controversial and expensive because it was so far out, and so delivering things was very, just very expensive. And then, sadly, it was just that people said, hey, these people should really have a harder life.
Right.
That doing it, it's cost too much. So at the moment, it's closed, but it was... fantastic idea, I thought.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
So based on your work with Sister Antonia, based on the work that you did that won you the Pulitzer, what are your beliefs about prisons? Can people be fixed? Can they redeem themselves?
I don't know about that, but certainly we know that prisons help make people, they harden people, depending on how they're run. And most of them, the ones in Mexico that we saw, were run incredibly badly.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody came out of that a better person, I think. But the thing that we did see in Mexico is that there were a lot of people in prison for stealing nothing. I mean, they stole a loaf of bread, and they didn't have the $20 to pay the fine or whatever it was. So they would end up serving year after year after year, and they just got forgotten.
Yeah.
I don't know who said it, but the last job in the world you want is to be a prison warden. It's just a horrible job, and running a prison is a terrible, terrible thing. Does any country do a good job of running prisons?
In a funny way, Mexico is a diverse country, but I thought that they had some of the most humane prisons, even though, as we know from El Chapo and other things, a lot of the biggies pay bribes and get out.
Yeah.
Right.
I actually thought, we've worked in a lot of countries, and they say that how you deal with the lowest among you says a lot about your culture.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And that there was a warmth and a belief in redemption there that certainly Mother Antonia and I believe in. I think that people are more than one thing. And so they kind of tipped the balance towards this person can come out and be a contributing member of society.
Escaping from prison in Mexico is not technically a crime. If you break a window to get out, if you hurt someone on the way out, that's a crime. But if someone leaves the door open and you walk out, it's not a crime to escape from prison because it's in the Mexican Constitution. And the theory is that everyone wants to be free. Everyone yearns to be free.
Wow.
So if you can, if you see an opportunity to be free and you don't hurt anyone or break anything, it's not a crime.
Wow. So there was one prisoner, they called him El Samsonite, because he went, he was small, and he got and he went into
you see
a,
where this is headed.
A piece of luggage and was wheeled out, and
excellent.
Nobody was hurt. And so well, ultimately, when they captured El Samsonite, he just went back in, no foul, no, you know.
Right.
So
right.
he just...
We'll just pick up where we left off.
Then he tried a duffel bag.
We talked to the equivalent of the Supreme Court justice, and he said, "Yeah, no more time. Everybody wants to be free. It's just a different philosophy."
That's fabulous.
Also, but as soon as you walk out that door, if a prison guard shoots you, that's fine too.
Right.
So I mean, you know, this is complicated stuff.
it's complicated to segue to your other book called Hope.
Yeah.
But. People who probably should have spent 5,000 years in prison was Ariel Castro, who kidnapped these three young women in Cleveland. And as we were saying before the show, and Jeannie and I read the book and I listened to it. And every page and every minute, I kept thinking, how can someone be so awful? And I thought of a few things going through the book. I thought of proximity. These poor girls were so close to their families.
Mm-hmm.
They were close to police who were in the neighborhood all the time. I thought about the psychological torture that he imposed on them. I used to work for John McCain, and he used to say that the psychological torture was far worse than the physical torture. The psychological torture this guy inflicted on those young women, telling them that he had seen Amanda's mother in a store.
Talked to her sister.
Yeah, and showing them things on Facebook was just absolutely awful. And then I thought of the miracle of that baby. But tell us how you guys first discovered this story. Well, we all knew about the story, but how you got connected and how you did the memoir of these two young women.
So remember, this was one of the biggest stories in the country, right? That they had discovered these three women who had been missing, one for over 10 years, one for 10, one for 9, and they were alive.
Mm-hmm.
And like you said, in this house in Cleveland, my hometown.
Yeah.
And so my parents came from Ireland. We were kind of in, we had a big family. We know a lot of the cops and the FBI. Mm-hmm. And they just said, hey, maybe you could help these girls tell their story, because everyone in the world wants to know. And, we wanted to make sure that they were well set up financially. So, and they are.
Yeah.
So we helped them write their story in that way.
That's fantastic. Mm-hmm.
But despite everything they went through, the thing that, and the reason we called the book Hope is, and there's a lot of rough stuff you have to kind of get through
in
their experience.
Yeah.
But we felt like if you didn't understand it, if you didn't know it honestly, you couldn't understand it. So, but the thing is, these girls never lost hope. That's why and one of the things that they would do is sometimes they would just sit and write hope over and over and again in a notebook. And, I'm not sure exactly how they did it. I think for Amanda, the baby that she had gave her a reason to stay alive and to stay optimistic and stay hopeful. But it's just remarkable that they were able to do that.
I would say the coolest thing is the resilience of people, right?
Yeah.
It speaks
the resiliency.
Yeah, you adjust to your reality, right?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And they would say, okay, one little thing is going to happen today. I'm going to get up and one little thing. And a song would come on the radio that would remind, Amanda of her mother. And she's like, okay, I can get through this day. And every day it was latching on to a small thing.
But how did you two go through the retelling of that story? Because as I was reading the book, I thought, I have just got to read this in the morning, because if I read this in the evening, I am not going to sleep tonight. How did you two get through that, their reliving of it?
Yeah, that's got to be just incredibly grim.
It was, but we've been doing this for a long time, and we've both written about, pretty rough things. And people used to ask me that while I was doing it. I said, well, what I was doing right before the book was hanging out in Syrian refugee camps.
Right.
So you get a little bit of leather, you develop a little bit of a thick skin, and
But on the other hand, I would say that I felt like I didn't need leather, because here we were talking to these people. They're back.
They lived.
They're alive.
They're back.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I was like, hey, this is cool. Yeah. We can kind of go through a lot of hell and come out.
There's something good at the end of it. Yeah.
And we're sitting interviewing Amanda in the house that was donated to her and that was renovated by contractors who donated their time. And she's just come from the doctor whose time has been donated. I mean, the whole city of Cleveland and the whole country, really, for a while, just gave so much of themselves to help these girls. It was just a remarkable outpouring.
There, at one point, we went into the house, and there was, you know, some guy who had never heard of them was a plumber, was fixing this, you know, the painters, and people were bringing food, and you know, like the Cleveland Clinic, you know, was saying, anything you need for the rest of your life. And, you know, it was, I don't know, I thought it was... Pretty awesome.
Mary had dinner with Amanda one night, and they picked some very quiet little restaurant way out of the way in the middle of nowhere, and they went to pay the check, and the witch said, "No, that guy, someone who's left has already paid for your."
I kind of got a sense. I know Cleveland. I'm from Pittsburgh. I know Cleveland pretty well, and you got this sense of Cleveland being a small town. It's not.
No, it's a very big town.
But you got this sense of being a small town. The police knew Ariel Castro and knew his family. He got stopped once or twice by the police, and they knew him because they had been in that neighborhood for so long. Everybody knew everybody. But the thing that really, really struck me was Amanda having a baby with this horrible, horrible, horrible guy. But it seemed as though that was almost a turning point because the three young girls, didn't get along that well. To me, it seemed like they didn't get along that well.
Went back and forth.
And there seemed to be, and he fueled some animosity. I'm making this up, so stop me if I'm, you know, going too far.
That was the whole thing.
There was animosity.
That was a psychological divide.
Right. Yeah.
He would say, oh, you know, Amanda told me, Gina, that you did this. That means you're not going to get food tonight. So he was turning them against
each
other.
He didn't want them united, right?
He didn't want a united force.
Talk about the baby, about Jocelyn coming onto the scene.
She changed everything for Amanda. You know, and also imagine getting pregnant, being pregnant, having a baby, and then delivering the baby and living with the baby and never once seeing a doctor or anyone who knew anything about medicine.
Yeah.
It's just incredible. And she did it through just sheer willpower. But it gave her, you know, she set up a little, when Jocelyn was old enough to start learning, and she'd think, okay, how old do you have to be when you start kindergarten or preschool? She set up a little classroom in the house.
With letters on the
walls. With letters and pictures of animals and colors and shapes and all of the stuff. And she taught herself how to be a preschool teacher and then a kindergarten teacher and then a first grade teacher. And when Jocelyn came out, the teacher said, this is kind of amazing. She's pretty much on grade level.
Oh my God.
I'm not sure if it says something really wonderful about her as a mother or it says something terrible about the state of public education.
I prefer
a little from column A, a little from column B.
But it also changed the relationship with the other girls. They loved having, he loved, and I found, again, it's just people get both of these books, but get this book because Ariel Castro was clearly a horrible, horrible person. But he loved this baby. And Amanda even talks about how she had affectionate feelings toward him because of his love for that baby. And it just seemed to have changed the mood in this horrible place so dramatically.
And the baby was born on Christmas Day.
Yes.
But I'd say to tie these two books together, one of the things that I've learned is that Mother Antonia was depressed after two divorces, and she started helping other people in Mexico and found a calling. And when I came home and said, oh, my God, this woman had light coming through her eyes. She was so happy. Yeah. She had a purpose in life. And and same thing in this hell of this Cleveland kidnapping case is the baby comes along, and everybody's not thinking about themselves again.
Right.
They
yeah.
started thinking, how are we going to this little baby needs us.
Yeah.
And you get out of your own head.
Right.
And you don't worry about yourself. You're thinking of others. I've seen this, and it was, you know, I feel like I was really lucky to have met all of these people because they've certainly taught me.
How old is Jocelyn now? How old would
she turn? She just turned 12.
Wow. And how much does she? She must remember a lot. But how have they explained all of this to her?
You know, gently and slowly. Mm-hmm. And I think Amanda has been careful to not say your father was a monster. I think she's been very careful to kind of preserve what she can of that relationship that Jocelyn, because Jocelyn obviously knew her father.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Right.
And
he was very kind
to
her.
Amanda took her out
into the world.
Right.
Yeah, he did.
Yeah.
And Amanda was very upset when he killed himself after 30 days in prison. Yeah. Number one, because they said he couldn't take for a month what he put us through for 10 years.
Right. 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 Exactly.
And she said, I wanted Jocelyn to be able, when she was old enough, to ask him these questions. Why did you do this?
Yeah.
You know, what was it? So she could have her own, you know, closure on this thing.
He was an incredibly narcissistic guy. I mean, clearly, deeply troubled, but an incredibly narcissistic guy. Yeah. Having been pregnant 3 times, there's not really a fun period during that. Mm. And Amanda was maybe 6 months along, and he's complaining about his ears were ringing or something like that. Absolutely no sympathy for what she was going through. It was all about him. One of the things that I found, this proximity issue, his son, whose name was Ariel Castro, was writing an article for a Bowling Green newspaper. His son, Ariel Castro, goes and interviews the moms of one of the girls who was being held captive by his father.
Jesus.
What is his family doing now?
The son?
Yeah.
The son was...
His son, a daughter who came to the house while they were there?
The son was completely uncooperative with us. Other relatives of his helped, but he didn't help us at all.
I mean, think of it. He had the same name as one of the most notorious.
Yeah.
He'd be changing my name.
He did.
Yeah. I mean, that was tough for his family. They didn't ever think that this was happening. You know, I mean, this guy who had done this was a musician. I mean, on all appearances, you know, he was a bus driver.
He had a real life.
He was a school bus driver.
Yeah. And he was a pretty active member of that community, right?
And his daughter was friends with these kidnapped girls.
Oh.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And we talked to the daughter, and, you know, and she was heartbroken by this. And there was, as Mary says, the thing that shines through here is the goodness. I mean, there was a lot of evil here.
Yeah.
But the thing that really shines through is the goodness in people, and including his daughter, who was, when we talked to her, it was just heartbreaking. She said, if I had known, if there was anything I could have done.
Yeah. You
know. We were talking to Gina yesterday. You know, she was a baby when she was picked up, right? And,
yeah.
You know, and she was in there. And so she's still in her 20s after, you know. Mm. And she said, I'm opening a little office really close to the house where we were kidnapped. And I said, my God.
Why?
You know, why wouldn't you pick maybe a different neighborhood in Cleveland?
Sure.
And she said, you know, I think that's where the need is. And somebody had given her this space for $1 a month.
Yeah.
So she goes in there, and if any families want to talk to her, they can.
Wow.
Isn't that cool?
That's very cool.
You know, Amanda also has a gig on one of the local television stations in Cleveland where she records every evening's newscast. Has a missing children's report with Amanda Berry. And she says, tonight's missing child is so-and-so, and here are the details. And she's forced herself to get out in the public eye and do this, which was pretty hard for her. She's very shy.
Didn't their case cause a lot of people to start to reinvestigate long-standing missing kids, cold cases?
Yeah.
And so there actually was a real infusion of support and enthusiasm.
Actually, the Justice Department called them up here in Washington and talked to them and said, tell us, you know, what we did wrong and right. And she said, well, the key, the lifeline is the new... We wanted to hear about ourselves on the news.
Right.
If we didn't. And she said, on the anniversary of one, like, she had been held 7 years. She goes, you know, she goes, okay, I'm just going to make it another month, and I'm going to see myself on the news. And then there was a garbage strike in Cleveland.
And that bumped them off. Blew everything off.
Yeah. So because of that, now there's all these public announcements, and because this is the avenue in. Right?
Sure.
You don't know where they're held, but hopefully they have a TV. Yeah.
Did they ever, did the girls, the young ladies, did they ever express any animosity or any whatever toward the neighbors? That the neighbors didn't see something weird, sense something weird. The guy did seem like a very normal, active member of the community. But
they were just confused. I mean, we went around and interviewed all the neighbors, and every single one of them said he just seemed like, maybe he seemed a little weird, but, you know, he would come over and buy lemonade from our kids when they were selling lemonade in the summer.
Took barbecue, he cooked some stuff on the grill and took it to the neighbors?
The guy that found him, I mean, he's like, I had ribs with that guy. I mean, the barbecue's in the neighborhood.
Exactly,
Yeah.
And people say, I wonder, why didn't anybody see how weird the house was? Well, you know, drive through some neighborhoods anywhere.
Yeah. Who talks to their neighbors anymore?
Also, look at a house, and if you see the curtains drawn, how do you know there isn't a piece of wood, plywood, hammered to the window behind it? You don't.
But now, you know, after one collateral damage is I do that.
We do it all the time. I wonder who's in that basement.
You know, I think this house is a little weird. And so I was at a dinner party, and in this house that I've really been honing in on, thinking,
something's going on there.
She said she lived there. And I'm like,
They tore down the house, right? They raised
they
the
did.
House that they were
did.
In.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. Again, yeah. The sense of community with Cleveland was really something through this.
And Gina's office, the one that Mary was talking about, is on that street.
Yeah.
They're so brave.
Yeah,
they
really
are.
Are.
You know, I can't find a parking spot.
It's a legit big town, small town. Yeah. Like, they are knit together. Yeah. They really are. Yeah.
So what's the next book, you guys?
Well, we were going to do the David Aldridge story.
Stop!
We've been approached.
A pamphlet?
We've been approached.
I'd like to be interviewed. I have a story about David and a camel that needs to be included in that. In that
all
book.
The girls I've loved before.
We did. We've contributed chapters to a couple of books. We did. We were part of that Trump. The Washington Post did a biography of Donald Trump, and we worked on that. Contributed chapter.
You know,
to that.
This has been a really fun, nice show, and then
just
brought it right down.
All right. We also did much better. There's a book called Nine Irish Lives, and it's a story about it's nine chapters about people born in Ireland who came to the United States and made a difference and did something remarkable.
Wow.
And we contributed
Susan Brophy on that list?
Susan Brophy is she's the 10th Irish line.
There we go.
She is.
There we go. Mutual friend.
And I think I mentioned my mom came to this country in the 50s as a cleaning lady.
Wow.
She cleaned houses in Shaker Heights, Ohio. And then my dad came as a farmer. And, you know, they did the thing. They did this because we were all supposed to go to school. And I'm kind of the dumbest in the family, and everybody else are lawyers and doctors. And so
you have the best taste in men.
Boom. It's so true. Oh, I shouldn't say that because
they might hear this.
The in-laws will hear this. Oh, shit.
Yeah.
Oh, they know. Okay. They know.
They know.
No, but we are going to write a story about growing up on West 179th Street because it was a little unusual about what was going on in that household. My mom, for instance, she had five daughters, and if you were wearing a short skirt and you weren't listening to make it longer and not go out with that, she would throw water on you so that you were soaked and then you couldn't go out.
Oh,
but
nice.
They had very interesting parenting techniques.
Nice. Yeah.
The old country.
But it was cold water,
very,
I hope.
Very nice.
Okay, part of one of my many New Year's resolutions is to wrap this show up in less than an hour.
Would you stop?
Yeah. I have to do this. I have to do this. No,
awesome.
5 minutes. But one of the things we do, and we'll put you guys on the spot for it as well, is our desert/deserted island recommendations. And so everybody goes around and you recommend if you were going to a deserted island or a desert island, and you could only take one book with you, what book would you
take?
They
don't have islands in the desert, really, do they?
They just have islands.
Deserted
islands.
You know,
is what
I think
you mean.
If the Saudis are probably creating their own islands,
yeah,
they probably are.
Somewhere near
If you were Amelia Earhart, what book did you want on that island?
Exactly.
Yeah. She was such a weird duck.
Well, she was. I don't know what she'd want.
That makes me think of Lindbergh.
The movie was very good.
In
the movie was very good. Did you see the movie?
Yeah, but I want somebody in 2019, 2020 to do a really, really good book on Lindbergh, who was a
wackadoodle. Oh, he was a wackadoodle.
There's a lot going on with that.
The plot against America.
Yeah.
We knew that you did this, so I asked
you prepped?
A great friend of ours at work, David Finkel, who's also a spectacular.
Yeah.
So, David.
And a Pulitzer Prize winner.
Who isn't?
Damn it.
Who isn't?
They're going like weeds out here.
Handing them out now.
That brand has really gotten cheapened.
So, David, okay, you're on a desert island. You can have one book. What's the book? And he said, a book on boat building.
Well, yeah.
There you go.
That'll come in handy.
Outstanding.
Excellent. All right, David, first up.
Do I have 2 minutes?
You've got all the time in the world, man.
2 minutes?
What do you want?
2 minutes. Yeah, you do, as a matter of fact.
Weave some things together.
Yeah,
okay.
You do.
I think this is new. I don't think I've said this before. But today, unfortunately, is the 33rd anniversary of the Challenger disaster.
Yes.
Yes.
33rd. The book is The Right Stuff by Tom Wolfe.
Great one.
I'm not familiar with him.
Not familiar with his genre, with his oeuvre. The book is phenomenal. It's about the early days of the U.S. space program. It's about Chuck Yeager and the fighter pilots who became who eventually became the early Mercury 7 astronauts,
right?
that got us into orbit. Not into outer space, but into orbit, you know, so John Glenn got us into orbit. But the reason why I remember that book, why I thought about that book today is because today is the anniversary. 33 years ago, my mother was still alive. My mother died that year in 1986, but she was, in January of 86, she was healthy. She had had cancer. She was in remission. Everything was fine. And I was home that day. I was at American University, but I was on winter break. So I was home that day, and I was working on something. I can't remember what it was. And I watched the launch. And again, in those days, that's what you did.
Everybody
you stopped what
watched.
You did and watched the launch.
But remember, at that point, people had kind of gotten used to the space shuttles going up.
Yeah, it's going up.
And so everybody
watched
it.
Funny that you mentioned that.
And nothing bad happened.
It's funny that you mentioned that, because I watched the launch and had no sense that anything had gone wrong, because I was working on something for school. And my mother came downstairs and said, "What just happened to the space shuttle?" And I said, "What do you mean? It just launched." She said, "No, something just happened." And I snapped out of whatever I was in and looked and said, "Oh my God."
Yeah.
and it's one of the last memories I have of my mother being healthy.
Oh,
and so,
interesting.
That's kind of a weird.
It is weird, but there's a lot of things tied together.
Happy, sad.
But all of it is, all of it comes from this book, this book about the Mercury Severin astronauts by Tom Wolfe, which is this amazing. Amazing chronicle of the early days of the space program in the United States. It's an incredible book.
Good one.
Thank you.
David, Jeannie.
So I really like this book called The Shock of the New by Robert Hughes, who was the art critic for Time magazine for 25 years. Australian-born, incredibly opinionated art critic. But I happen to...
Shocking. Can you separate those two things?
But he's even... more than what you would ever think of an art critic.
Uh-huh. There's a few I can think of.
But I happen to agree with him on most things. And it's about the art of the 20th century. And it grew out of a BBC production that was, I think, 8 episodes. I'm sure ran on PBS. But if you if you want to get your head around the art of the 20th century and abstract expressionism and modernism and the way art moved through that century, this is the book for
How
you.
Long is it, and are there pictures?
There are...
I need pictures.
Well, there are 8, I think, chapters that are divided and have a theme. There are lots of pictures. And there are pictures that you will love, and there are pictures that you will hate. And
dogs playing poker?
It's not just about art. It's also,
that was 19th
it's also
century,
architecture
it?
And sculpture, but mostly art.
Okay. Excellent.
It's really
Love
great.
That. Michael always makes us smarter. Jeannie makes us more cultured.
Exactly.
And then we come to Mark.
And then we come to me. I actually bring this in because I was going to butcher this guy's name. You know I love
Hold
history.
Hold it up for News Channel 8.
You know I love history.
Yes.
Yes.
I didn't know that. Oh,
yes.
There he is.
There he is.
A little guy
there
named Napoleon.
Yeah, with a hand in his coat.
Little hands. You know what was in there? It was a sandwich. Because he was always hungry.
A little baguette.
It's funny that we were talking about Pride and Prejudice. Because this is a book by Armand de Caulaincourt, if I'm probably butchering the pronunciation.
Sure, works for us.
He was an aide to Napoleon and accompanied him on the invasion into Russia and the subsequent retreat from Russia, which is this horrible sequence where basically the entire Grand Armée was, you know, wiped out over this trek because they're just walking from Moscow back to France
Bad
in the
decision.
Middle of winter.
Short
wolves,
little jaunt.
You know, it's like, hey, where'd Francois go? The wolves got him. And this guy was a close aide to Napoleon and was with him throughout this entire thing. And I've said this before, there are very few things better than an eyewitness account to history. And this is a fascinating event in history. Mm. And this guy was right there. Like the prelude to it, everything to, you know, all the way through it. And it's just a fascinating read. In fact, there were German officers who read this as the Germans were invading Russia, but evidently they didn't learn anything because they did the exact same thing.
They didn't
thing.
Take notes.
Yeah,
no.
So, but it's a fascinating
And there
glimpse.
Were no pictures or maps, so
no.
Confusing.
But
okay.
A fascinating glimpse into history.
Kevin and Mary, your turns.
You know, I've been reading poetry, and it may... and because,
why?
Because Mary, no, Mary
why?
Oliver
Stop.
Died.
Stop, we love poetry.
Mary
oh,
Oliver
yeah.
Put a beret
died,
on her
and
now.
She, you know, I'm Irish, and so we really get into death, and, you know, I started rereading her books.
We live
books.
To die.
So, Susan's out there not listening. I want somebody to explain to me why, with the Irish, it is either incredibly dark and tragic and wet and just, you know, Angela's ashes or cute little leprechauns eating cereal.
What else is there?
There's nothing in between.
What else is there?
You want boring in the middle? Is that what you're looking for?
Would you like to learn some German?
Variations on the theme, but I'm sorry.
It's who we are.
Yeah. It's your
and okay, we do but good funerals,
but it's Irish.
Oh, we do.
So is it limericks?
No,
oh,
no.
Damn.
I think
oh, no.
She's
a wonderful poet,
Mary Oliver. She talked a lot about the amazement of life, and I don't want to be a visitor on this earth. And it was just really nice. It's maybe an anecdote to social media. I don't know what it is, but I'm really enjoying. I mean, she and other poets, you know, William Butler, they spent a lot of time with few words.
Uh-huh.
Few words are good.
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
Few words are good. Albert Einstein once said, make everything as simple as possible, not one bit simpler, which is perfect. Kevin?
I have two answers, so.
No, one.
One? Okay. One.
We'll allow two.
We'll allow two?
Yeah.
We have a ruling.
Yeah.
We're 3 minutes over, but go ahead.
Our friend Tim Shriver is here, and he wrote a book a couple of years ago called Fully Alive, and it's a fantastic book about what it truly means to live in service of other people, and I highly recommend it. It's a great book. If I'm stuck on a desert island, what I'm also bringing is anything by my friend Ben McIntyre, the British journalist who writes a lot of World War II nonfiction spy stories. Ooh. And I'm not a World War II guy, but these books will just hook you in. He wrote a book about Kim Philby, the spy, called The Spy Among Friends.
I love those.
But this guy, Oleg Gordievsky, who was this book called The Traitor and the Spy, Operation Mincemeat. I mean, he's got a whole shelf full of them, and each one is better than the last one.
And they're nonfiction.
They're nonfiction.
Love that.
Ben has had unique access to the MI5 and MI6 archives. I think because he may have some family connections. I'm not really sure. But he's been able to get a hold of records that no one else has been able to get a hold of, and he writes like a dream.
Oh, that's lovely. Okay, mine being fresh from Vietnam and Cambodia. It's by David Lam. It's called Vietnam Now. David Lam. Wait, you're waving your hands. Why are you waving your hands?
We love David
Lam. Oh, my gosh.
He's a good friend. Yeah.
It's a remarkable book, and I've read a lot about Vietnam. But David was a UPI reporter covering Vietnam in the 70s during the American War, as they call it in Vietnam. And then he went back and started the LA Times Bureau in the 1990s after normalization relations. And it's a wonderful book, and it is so insightful, and it is so well written. I'm not a good reader, and I usually have to read something 3 or 4 times to really understand it. But you just read it, and it's beautiful, and it's wonderful, and it explains a lot.
When I was a backpacker roaming around Africa, we had one copy of David Lam's book, The Africans, that everybody passed around.
And you were in Apocalypse Now, a great bar in Saigon. Yeah,
it's a good bar.
We were trading emails, and it is still there. It is alive and well. A lot of expats still go in there. And it was very crowded the night we went by it. It was very crowded because Vietnam was playing Japan in the quarterfinals of the ASEAN Cup. But it was a very big night. Very, very big night. Okay, Mark, get us out of here, honey.
This was fantastic. Thank you, guys.
Spectacular.
Yes.
This is best ever.
Thank you, Mary George. Kevin Solomon.
This was just fantastic. We will be back next week. Who's going to be on with us next week?
We'll be back next week, continuing in the sort of geopolitical scene of things. Tom Shanker and Eric Schmidt of the New York Times, fabulous, fabulous national security correspondents, who wrote a book a few years ago called Counterstrike about Al-Qaeda, the American campaign against Al-Qaeda. And I, for one, think we are all getting a little complacent, and we're kind of thinking these things aren't threats anymore. So they can talk about their book. They can also talk about what's going on right now.
And we'll be starting taping right around 5:30 next week.
Yes, we will.
Right
to make
here,
room for
yes, the coaches show with Gary Williams.
Yeah, yep. Where's the coaches show this week?
They're coming back, making a triumphant return next week.
All right.
Next week. We are right on the corner of Wisconsin and Jennifer at Chatter. Thank you guys for coming.
Thanks
thank
for
you
coming
everyone
in, you too.
For listening. And we'll see you next week.
Thanks, guys.
And thank you.
Thanks to Eddie Connor for being here, too.
Oh, my gosh, yes.